Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or just through restaurantguysradio.com, and now you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning there, Marky.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well indeed, thanks. How are you this morning?
It's very well. We're going to talk about some serious stuff today.
Yeah, there have been a couple of studies out about a number of different things. One of the things that really concerns us, because we talk a lot about food and diet, we see health risks. We see health problems increasing with our children. We see obesity, diabetes, all these things just seeming to be getting worse as we are better and better fed.
Even while people are living longer, we're living less healthily longer.
There's an article in about a study that was just done. Check this out. This is a truly bizarre risk from eating hamburgers. Parents beware. Children who eat hamburgers just once a week are twice as likely to develop asthma and wheezing problems, foodconsumer.org reports of a new study from New Zealand that specifies so. Specifically, kids who eat one hamburger a week or more are 75% more likely to have asthma and 100% more likely to have wheezing problems. And it's not just hamburgers. Many foods you might purchase at a fast food restaurant, including soda pop, were found to increase the risk of asthma, according to researchers at the Wellington Asthma Research Group based at the Wellington Medical School in New Zealand. Pretty wild, huh?
Yeah, I think that most people would never think that a hamburger would be something that would increase asthma. That's something you might be allergic to. But I think there's a lot of issues here and a lot of potential underlying issues.
I just think that one of the things that we talk about a lot is the rise of processed foods. And we don't know. Look, we're not malnourished, okay?
Right.
But being sufficiently nourished, it seems on paper anyway. Why are we getting sicker?
Right, and we're not just talking about, though, here, especially when you're talking about mainstream hamburgers. What most people eat when they have a hamburger is a fast food hamburger. That's most of the hamburgers that are being consumed in the United States. And you're talking about potentially using genetically modified foods. And those of you who listen to the Deborah Coons Garcia show with us, you realize that there are a lot of things being put in our food that we don't know about. And I think there are a lot of, and some of them are potential allergens, and some of them lead to bigger problems that we don't know about. And that's, I'm petrified that we're experimenting right now with no retreat, with no where to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scary for me.
I think that it's interesting that, as again, if you look at our society, as we get better nourished, there's enough food around.
Mm-hmm.
Why is everybody getting sick?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And there are so many sicknesses that are on the rise inexplicably and in our children.
And asthma is definitely one of them.
I mean, asthma. Allergies. I mean, do you remember peanut allergies when you were a kid? Did you know anybody who had peanut allergies?
Nobody ever talked about peanut allergies when I was a kid.
And now you got the peanut-free section of your school, right?
You can't. You,
so something's going on. And what's rising more and more is that we are more and more dependent on processed food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, look at a fast food hamburger. Does that look like a hamburger you would make at home?
Right.
I mean, it's almost like a different food.
It doesn't look anything like it.
I remember, you know, when I was a kid, my mom would say, well, I'll make you a hamburger. Like, she thought that was better than the McDonald's burger. But, you know, I had been convinced by Ronald that I wanted one of those flat things.
See, not me. I wanted the little toy surprise in the bag or at the bottom of the cereal box.
We have a whole host of issues that arise when we talk about food and our food supply, and I think that our assumptions are not always correct.
Yeah, I will tell you that I don't know the background of the study. I know that it was 1,300 children between the ages of 10 and 12. I know that the research was done in New Zealand. I don't know the specifics of this study. I'm just reading an article that somebody summarized this particular study. But I'll tell you, it does really make sense to me that other problems are coming from this, other problems that maybe we didn't think would be a problem when we were genetically modifying that corn or when we were using that specific herbicide or pesticide in planting that wheat that grew and became part of the bun in the burger. We're feeding that cow what we fed it or the antibiotics that we fed that cow. It doesn't surprise me that there are long-term ramifications to that.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. When we think about things that are counterintuitive, like that you're an increase in hamburgers, like who eats more hamburgers is more likely to have asthma. I want to talk about the use of gloves. There was an article recently in Restaurants and Institutions magazine about gloves, and it talks about how in many states, gloves are required for anyone who touches food. Mm-hmm. In New Jersey, thank heaven, it's not. We actually, working with the New Jersey Restaurant Association, defeated a bill like that a couple of years ago.
And I think that the instinct for most people is, oh, you're using gloves, that must be cleaner.
And one of the things is that studies have shown that when restaurant employees and food service employees have gloves on, they feel invincible. They feel like, I have gloves on, it's fine. But there are many instances of employees who, like in this article, it quotes a manager who says, I've watched an employee with his gloves on go to the bathroom, come back with the same gloves on, and get back to work. And basic hygiene is basic hygiene. If you wash your hands well and often, as our chefs do and our line cooks do and anyone who touches food in our restaurant does, you can wash your hands every 10 minutes, and they do. And when you go from fish to meat, you do. And when you go from poultry to anything, you do.
There's another logical assumption here that I want people to realize. When you get something on your hand, you feel it.
Yep.
You sense that it's there. When you get something on a rubber glove, you may not notice it. You may have gotten some pathogen on your hand and not felt that it was slippery or oozy or whatever, that because it feels like because you're wearing a glove.
And there's really nothing inherently cleaner about a gloved hand than an ungloved hand. And of course.
Unless you don't clean your hands.
Or if you're if you have a terrible disease and you're oozing from an open wound. But that's not really the case. If someone has a wound, they wear a glove. You know what I mean? No, but I mean, I'm serious. You're
serious and ridiculous all in the same moment.
But it's almost like that's what people think gloves protect you from the infection oozing out of the employee. The idea where pathogens come from in food service is by cross contamination. Is the person who's working with the raw chicken and then goes over and works with the salad, and that's where people get sick in restaurants. It's not from the employee with typhoid. What I mean? That's not where it comes from. And so gloves give you a false sense of security, and we showed the amount of garbage. Now, the restaurant employee...
Something that people never think of.
...is the second largest employer in the state of any kind in the restaurant retail. If every one of us has to wear gloves and change them every half an hour, it will fill a landfill in less than 10 years just for restaurant employee gloves.
Just for gloves.
And
just
it doesn't anything.
Right.
And in fact, I mean, I remember the time that we went to the wedding. You remember this?
And
it was white glove service, and the waiter had white cotton gloves on, and they were serving manigot, right? And he took his gloved finger and cleaned his ear with it, examined the wax on the glove.
Beautiful Q-tip.
And then went back to the manigot, and I was like, you want the manigot? Nope.
No. I'm just going to skip. I'm not hungry.
Lasagna. No, that's I'm done. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Shot of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today our guest is our friend Kathy Corison. Kathy Corison is the owner of Corison Winery in Napa, where she makes some beautiful wine in California. She's been making wine for a long time out there. She's also a trailblazer in that many years ago when Kathy started, there weren't many women in the wine business. It was a male-dominated industry, and Kathy's helped to kick down some doors. And she's actually going to be in town next week. And on Wednesday, March the 8th, if you're in New York City, at Salon, there is going to be tasting with Kathy and a lot of other of our favorite winemakers, women in the wine business. The tasting is for an organization called Women for Wine Sense. It's only $30, and it's at Salon on 505 West Street near Jane Street in downtown Manhattan. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy. How you doing?
I'm terrific.
So what's up with all these women in the wine business? I don't know how I feel about that.
it's a miracle. In the 30 years I've been in the wine business, it's been gone from no women at all, except in laboratories, to women at every single level.
It does seem like there's been a big change, some big changes, and I looked up some of the statistics on it, and Historian William Heintz wrote that there were about 10% women in the wine business in 1890. And then Eileen Crane took a look at the statistics in 1990, and they were almost identical. And in the last 15 years, it's gone up to almost 20%.
That's nearly
double the amount of women in the business. That's a big deal.
I remember, actually, Kathy, before we met, and it was just before we met, there was an article in the New York Times, I believe it was the New York Times Magazine, and it was after you had worked, and I want to ask you about your career in a moment, but it was after you had worked through in a number of illustrious positions for other wineries, when you started the Coruscant label, and it was you sort of squatting on top of a barrel or standing on top of a barrel of your first vintage, and the title of the article was A Wine of One's Own. And
I
thought that was a great article. And then, like, 5 days later, five weeks later, I met you in Manhattan at a tasting, at a Cabernet tasting, and I thought, oh, that's
it's her.
It's
the squatting on the barrel woman.
Yeah, I've always been a bit of a monkey.
We have to be agile, moving all that stuff around. So what was it? I think that it's interesting to talk about what it was like to come up as a woman in a male-dominated industry and how, you know, you helped to change things.
Well, it's certainly been a ride, and it's been very exciting. And my angle has always been to just keep my mouth shut and do the best job I can. And I think that's probably been the most efficient way to bring about change, is just to make great wine.
Were there women for you to look up to in the business when you were coming up?
Well, there were a couple of women. Zelma Long was at Robert Mondavi. She was running the winemaking program. The difference between the path that the women ahead of me mostly had taken is that they had not been in small wineries, and I wanted to make world-class wine in a small winery. So that meant I had to do everything,
So you had to know how to do everything, and you had to
working
be
barrels, yeah.
physically lifting barrels and doing all the work.
Exactly.
Well, but also, I mean, why don't you tell people about how, I mean, you've had some positions of responsibility in the larger houses that you worked before that other women, that you sort of blazed some trails there first, right?
Yeah, large is a relative term, though, because I think Chapelet Vineyard, where I made the wine for all the 80s, still isn't a very large winery.
Right.
It's a small enough winery that I ran the day shift and I loaded presses. So
right.
It was still quite small.
Now, did you encounter any gender discrimination, do you think, when in the early years?
Sure. Took me a couple of years to get my first seller job.
Like, what kind of, was it sort of passive? Was it like a glass ceiling kind of a thing? Or what was it like?
Well, it was pretty expressed. You know, my major press professor,
no,
Davis, told me there's no way I was going to get a job in the Napa Valley as a woman.
Really?
He told me, well, I won't name it. He's not alive now, but... And then my first job in the cellar took 2 years to get. The winemaker wanted to hire me, and the owners blackballed it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
unbelievable. They vetoed it.
Were they pretty clear as to why they blackballed it?
Yeah, it was a woman.
It wasn't just because
wow.
you were a nudge.
And you've seen me. I'm small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we get larger every year, and you pretty much stay the same size. So
that seems so wrong.
The differential is growing. I will say there was a friend of mine who had a restaurant in New Brunswick who has passed away. Great guy, but he had a similar kind of thing. He wanted men on the floor of the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to say, friend's name who has been changed, what are you, an idiot? He'd say, no, I don't like it. It's not professional. I said, listen. And we actually benefited from his stupidity over the years. He's a great guy, not stupid, except in this one area. Because I said, listen, buddy, anytime you get a qualified woman's resume, will you just send it to me, please?
And he did. He used to send us women all the time to work in our restaurant.
And it was great.
Well, when you look at it, you're cutting out 50% of the population,
sure.
and that just cuts your odds down.
Actually, it's like 52%, so it's even worse than half.
Yeah.
Now, you've had your own run of things. For how long now is Coruscant been? That's 10 years?
I've made 19 vintages.
Wow.
19 years?
I'm
Holy
selling
cow.
My 15th vintage.
Oh,
that's
my goodness.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, you have a new winery out there now, right?
Yes. At long last, I finally have a home.
It seems like every time I went out there to visit, you're like, we're building the barn. We're building the barn.
I have to tell you.
But the barn is being built. The barn has doors now.
The last time that we were out there, Kathy has this beautiful property right in Napa by the Kronos Vineyard, which is her vineyard on the Napa Valley floor. And we went to visit. We had an appointment to come down and say hello. We had a little lunch. And we got to the barn where these doors, these monumental doors, two stories tall, no doorknobs. We were wondering if you were trying to send us a message. Hey, listen.
Well, when you're pulling on your bootstraps as hard as you can, you have to be patient.
And those, but we couldn't get in. There were no doorknobs. Our guest is Kathy Corison. She owns Corison Wines in California. We'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. You know, Mark and I are always saying that long-term, good environmental policy and good economic policy are one and the same. And that's not just for the government, it's also for small business and homeowners just like you. To help us put our money where our mouth is, we called E2ECTA. E2ECTA uses a team of specialists to find practical ways for your business or home to conserve energy and even to generate green energy that the utility company then has to buy back from you. That generates a different kind of green for your bottom line. We've gone solar at our restaurants. We're now producing cheap, non-polluting electricity, and with the help of E2ECTA, we did it for very little money. The government programs available to get you set up are unbelievable. We're talking about grants here, not loans, but grants. E2ECTA will help you find the right programs for you, and they'll do the paperwork. You keep the profits. It's a no-brainer, people. For lower energy usage, more profits for yourself, call E2ECTA at 908-359-9300 or click on their link at restaurantguysradio.com. E2ECTA for total energy solutions. Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We are talking today with Kathy Corison, who's a friend of ours who owns Corison Winery out in Napa Valley, California. You may have heard us mention earlier that we have George Hendry coming to do a wine dinner with us this coming Tuesday, the 7th, which is tomorrow. And Kathy is going to be in town doing an event for an organization called Women for Wine Sense. She'll be in Manhattan at a place called Salon. For $30, you can go see her and a bunch of other women winemakers who are bringing some rare vintages.
And taste
that you
about
can
25
try.
Different really rare, hard-to-find wines, like Kathy.
And you can check that out on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll tell you how to get there. Now, Kathy, you make Cabernet, and your Cabernets are phenomenal. I'm going to talk about them more in the next segment because they really do merit a bit of discussion. But you also make a couple of other – you make another wine, Alsace-inspired wine. Well, what's that all about?
Well, it's really just goofing around. I only make a couple hundred cases, so it's almost a home winemaking scale. But I love the wines of Alsace because of the way they're built and the way they go with food. And I wanted to make a white wine so that I could have a white wine to serve with first courses when I do winemaker dinners. So I have a white wine in the summer to greet people that come to the winery. And just to make white wine, it's a completely different thing. And so rather than make just another pretty Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc, I found a wonderful old vineyard up in Anderson Valley in the in Mendocino County, and that of Gewürztraminer. I make it into a completely dry Alsatian style.
And it's really nice.
It's fun to make and it's fun to drink.
Is that a vineyard that you own, or is that a vineyard you lease?
No, I buy the grapes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, I'll tell you that we carry, I mean, she's not going to find Kathy's Gewürztraminer. She's primarily a Cabernet maker, and she makes very little of this stuff. But, well, because we're buddies, she sends us a little bit of the Gewürztraminer from the Anderson Valley where it's cooler. And I generally don't like American Gewürztraminer. It's a very spicy white grape that can be sort of overdone. But Kathy's,
especially if the sugar levels get too high.
And Kathy's is really excellent, and it's called Corazon, or with a Spanish accent, Corazon.
And I'll give a little plug to a friend. There's a place down in Atlantic City, New Jersey, called Doc's Oyster House that also carries it.
And Corazon, I love the double entendre on Kathy's name, Corazon. Corazon in Spanish means heart, and it's the wine of your heart. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
That's super. Hey, listen, we're talking with Kathy Corison of Corison Wines in Napa, California. We'll be talking with her more after the news, and you can find out a time to meet her this week in New York City if you want to at a Women for Wine Sense event. It's only $30. Check it out. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We are talking today with our friend Kathy Corison, who owns Corison Winery in California. If you don't know Corison Wines, Kathy makes some of the finest, most elegant, most age-worthy Cabernet in California. In our restaurant, we have a vertical selection of many vintages, and it's amazing, amazing wine. And part of the reason that we're talking to Kathy today is because she's going to be in New York City this week on Wednesday, March the 8th. If if you want to go to a tasting with wines from Kathy Corrison, Celine, Mia Klein from Celine, Chase Family Cellars, Austrian wines from Nikolai Hoff, German wines from Darting, Barolo from the firm of Ypres, all wines made by women, some rare and hard-to-find wines.
Our friend Katerina Day will be there.
You can go to Cellona for $30. Taste some, I mean, incredible, incredible wines, and it'll benefit women for wine scent. Kathy, we were talking about your Gewürztraminer earlier. One of the things I think that's really interesting about your Cabernet is I find that most of the high-scoring big California Cabernets are not really very age-worthy, in my opinion. Your wines, I mean, back to your first vintage, just do incredibly well to age. Why is that? What do you do differently, do you think? And do you agree with me?
Oh, absolutely. It's really important to me. I think my model is more European than California. I want to walk that line between power and elegance and have wines built and have structures to age. And that means good, firm acidity and lots and lots of layers of flavors that can evolve over time. And it all starts in the vineyard. And I think that's why I source my grapes from the Rutherford Bench area, because they tend to ripen with beautiful structure and aromatics.
And your vineyard's right on the Kronos vineyard, right? You're
right on the bench, yeah. Mm.
Now, do you think that your wines are, you know, less powerful when young, maybe show less obviously when they're young? Because I found a lot of people don't sort of appreciate them as well when they're young and on first release. And then I'll bring out the older vintages, because we do have a couple of older vintages on our wine list, and people are, you know, are blown mm-hmm. away by the wines as they age.
I mean, you not too long ago released your 95, and I thought that was great to release some 95, you know, some 10-year-old wine.
Out of the library, mm-hmm. yeah.
Do you think that there's a price to be paid up front for that? Do you think that the wine maybe doesn't show as powerfully in the beginning to get that sort of ageability?
Well, you know, there's fashion in wine just like fashion in anything. And right now we're in a time when often wines are very obvious and ripe and sort of full-blown and obvious when they're young, but then they don't age very well. So mm-hmm. so if that's what
we see that a lot.
You're looking for, then I'd say, yes, I'm giving something up. But I'm not really, I don't think that style goes that well with food in the first place.
So I agree.
Wines that are more elegant and powerful are what I'm trying to do, both powerful and elegant. And it's a very fine line.
Let's talk about one of the ways that you accomplish that. I know that a lot of winemakers from close to you, not exactly where you are, but from fairly close to you, like to get their grapes really, really ripe. Brix is the sugar level at harvest. And their wines get up to, let's say, 28 or 30 Brix sometimes. And your wines tend to pick it in the 23 to 24 range. Why is that? What's the difference?
Well, more 24 to 25
okay.
range, really. But because it's really a matter of defining what is ripeness. And mm-hmm. for many people, it's the disappearance of green flavors. And in my opinion, if you have to get as ripe as 28 to 30 Brix to get the red flavors, then there's something wrong in the vineyard fundamentally. And I also think that I'm interested in still having those beautiful blue and red fruit flavors and the floral notes that Cabernet does so well.
Mm, it's not all just about the sugar and the ripeness.
Right. I think when grapes get as ripe as 28 and 30 Brix, they taste more like prunes.
Mm.
And, you know, it's just not as complex and interesting and certainly not as pretty.
The fruit dries out is what I see. And that's, I think, what you mean when you say prunes. Is that what you're
yeah.
trying to say?
You know, I one of the things about this event that's coming up that you're doing on Wednesday, which is at Solana, New York, again, we'll link people to it at our site. It's happening on the International Celebration of Women in the Wine Industry. One of the facts we uncovered when sort of researching the event and things to talk about with you today is that it turns out that now in America, the Gallup poll has recently shown that for the first time, wine has outpaced beer as a people's favorite beverage in America, but that 55% of the wine drinkers are women. And they show that women's buying patterns tend to be different than men. And one of the things that happens with women wine buyers overall, statistically, is they care less about a wine's score. Do you, as a winemaker, care less about a wine's score?
Well, it depends on whether I've got my marketing hat on or my winemaking hat.
Am I going to sell all my wine either way? Then it doesn't matter. That
I am going to sell all my wine either way. Exactly. So the answer is no, I don't. And if I cared about that, I wouldn't be as stubborn as I've been to make a wine that is still elegant.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could make wines, I think, that scored higher, again, by just increase letting them ripen a little bit longer. But, your wines have some really cool eucalyptus and menthol-y notes that I love.
I think that the interesting thing about scores is, you know, that's a uniquely American thing, and I frankly, Mark and I have railed against it for 10 years. You know, it's, and I think that the publications that score wines, that everybody reads, the Spectator, the Wine Spectator, and the Wine Advocate that people read, they do a great service to the wine world by introducing wine to people who might not otherwise buy it, to make it accessible to people. But we tend to focus on these scores, and what these scores represent are one person or two people's opinion of what a wine tastes like when it's very young, sometimes when it's in barrel. And it's often based on power rather than complexity. And because there are so few people that control the important scores, it's as if there was one art critic in the world who gave you a numerical score of a painting. I mean, it would be ridiculous if you went into the museum and you said, you know, what score did that painting get? You know, and that's sort of what a wine is, I think. Is it something to be appreciated as a craft, as a piece of art? And there's something about reducing it to a numerical score like that I think is, you know, wine's not a contest. I mean, are you with me on that, Kathy?
It's food.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just
right. Here's an apple. Here, I have a 97-point apple here for you. Enjoy this, okay?
As a radio host, I give Mark a 74.
It's just oversimplification.
Yes. You know, yes, and it has a place.
Well, and I also think that sometimes when you talk about scores, you don't talk about what a wine might necessarily be used for, whether it's for brunch or for lunch or for different wines are drunk at different times and are, you know, they're for different reasons.
All right, so Kathy, we only got a couple of minutes left for the salon tasting next Wednesday. What are you bringing for people to try if they come and they pay their $30? What are they going to get from Chorus and Wines?
Well, I'm bringing a library wine. I'm bringing the 94 out of my library. Just for fun. It's a wine that's long sold out, but it's fun to watch them when they have some nice bottle age. And then the current releases, which would be the 2002 Chorus and Cabernet and the 2001 Kronos Vineyard Cabernet.
Which is an awesome wine, by the way.
But you're bringing awesome. The 94. You're bringing a 12-year-old California Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I love to show the wines out of my library.
You know, it's funny.
We love when you show the wines out of your library, especially at really premier New Jersey restaurants. We love when you show them.
But actually, if you go to the salon event, Mark and I are going to be in attendance as well.
Mm-hmm.
We may even do a show from there. Who knows? We have the vertical collection of your wines on our wine list in the restaurant. I mean, these wines are just incredible. But you know what's interesting as working as a sommelier on the floor is Americans are so used to young wine that it's like the customers sometimes don't have the frame of reference to know what mature wine is supposed to taste like. Do you find that?
Well, I think it's often an epiphany for people, you know, but they just have to be open-minded, you know, because they're not fruit-driven anymore. They're all those secondary and tertiary things that happen and perfume and...
Well, if you're open-minded and you have $30 in your pocket and you'd like to go to a really cool wine event on Wednesday, you can go to Salon on West Street. You can find out the information about it. You can pay for a ticket at the door. It's only $30. And get some really rare and unusual wines, meet some cool winemakers, and meet the restaurant guys. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Kathy Corison of Corison Winery in California. She's here to talk about her wines from California and an event she's doing at Salon on West Street next Wednesday, March the 8th. It's an event to benefit Women for Wine Sense. It will have some rare California wineries, all made by women. Corison, Celine, Chase Family Vineyards, Domaine Serene, Karen Bray, Darting, Day, and Nikolai Hoff. And Pira will be there, and so will The Restaurant Guys.
Kathy, you have a couple of other wines that you're making under some other labels, and I think that's interesting. Talk to me about your Syrah and your Zinfandel and the other labels that you're doing and why those came about as other labels.
Well, I think it's just, I don't know any winemakers that really love to make wine and love wine that aren't goofing around with something. And all those things are made in vanishingly small quantities. They're literally home winemaking. I think it's one or two barrels of Syrah, one barrel of Zinfandel for a while. It's just for fun, really. Mm-hmm. And then the Helios label is a place to put wine that doesn't make the Corison blend, but I'm still very proud of.
Interesting.
So they're still beautiful wines, but they didn't make the cut for the blend, or they simply didn't fit.
It
can be perfectly good, but does not fit in the blend.
You know, I remember a while back we were visiting a winery called White Rock, and there's a French gentleman there, named Christian, and he blends the five different Bordeaux grapes. And Francis and I were talking to him, and we were very interested in tasting the different barrels separately, which we did. And one of the things that we came out from that experience was that those barrels, after he was done with his blend, was significantly better than any of the single grape varieties that we tried. And that was very curious to me. That's really part of what the winemaker's doing, is making sure that everything, you know, lands in balance, not just from the vineyard, but also from the different varieties that he's putting into his wine or her wine.
It's alchemy. And blending is not linear at all. The only way to know what you're going to get in a blend is to actually do the blend. And
right.
So we do that on a small scale to decide what the blend will be.
That's, like I said, I think that's very interesting. Are you putting anything else in with your Cabernet, or are you just blending Cabernet?
No, my Cabernet is 100% Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
I source different vineyards, and they all bring something different to the table, so that's where the complexity comes from. And of course, Cabernet makes a wonderful range of flavors when grown properly.
Now that's very unusual. You usually don't have 100% Cabernet Sauvignon grown out in California. That's an unusual choice for you?
Well, I'm a Cabernet chauvinist. I think that Cabernet can do anything those other varieties can do better most years, 9 out of 10 years.
Just so people out in the audience know, we're talking about usually when you make a Cabernet Sauvignon, even if it says Cabernet Sauvignon on the label, they can blend a certain percentage up of other grape varieties like Merlot or mm-hmm. Petit Verdot into the wine to sort of...
And still call it Cabernet Sauvignon.
Still call it Cabernet Sauvignon. So to find 100% Cabernet Sauvignon is quite unusual.
And
it's rare.
Now, Kathy, under the Corson label, you don't grow anything other than Cabernet. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So why not? Why never a Chardonnay? Why
because
never?
Because I'm a specialist.
You are indeed a specialist. You're special, though, Kathy. That's where it starts from. Okay, a specialist who's very, very special.
Now, when you travel, do you do a lot of wine dinners around the country?
Oh, I maybe a handful a year.
I find that is the best way to introduce consumers to wine is to sit down and have some food and have some wine together, because I find that when consumers, you know, if they go to a winery and they try six or seven wines, people are often disappointed when they get home because the wine isn't as they remember it, because that's a very different experience. That, I mean, Mark and I as professionals, and you as a professional, sort of taste a wine and can extrapolate from prior experience what that's going to be when you get it home. But I think that people are surprised that a wine is very different over dinner, is very different over time, is very different as the tannin builds up on your palate. And wine dinners, I think, are a great way to show the way a wine really should be.
Absolutely. We don't call it table wine for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you find most people do wine dinners well or not?
You know.
Have you ever had like a terrible situation where you go and like people are going to do a wine dinner and
come on, tell us. You don't have to tell us a place. Tell us.
Well, and the food and wine match is just awful.
Oh, yeah.
What, now, you don't have to tell us the place, but what would be a terrible food and wine match experience that you had?
You know, people keep trying to match my Cabernets with chocolate desserts.
Wrong Cabernet for that, huh?
Yeah, and sometimes it can work with Cabernet, but it's just not my favorite match. Mm. That's the first one that comes to mind.
So how do you deal with it when you're in the place, tier one, it's your wine dinner, and the food's making your wine show like crap?
Oh, that doesn't happen very often.
She's so nice, everybody. Kathy Corson, she just doesn't have a crossword about anyone, even when she's thinking it.
Because I'm telling you, Mark and I, we go to consumer wine events once in a while, and we often find that wine dinners just, there are, you know, at least there's one course that just doesn't work. And you want to say, you know, why did they do this?
Why didn't they taste it?
And if you're a restaurateur listening out there, you're in the business listening out there, if you're going to do a wine dinner, you're going to have someone present their wines in the evening, even that afternoon, you can open a couple, you can cook one plate of each of the foods, open the wine and try them side by side, and that will often lead to some last minute adjustments that make the 1 + 1 = 3 and avoid, you know, some terrible pitfalls. You know, that chive can really ruin your Chardonnay and you didn't know it was going to be there. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, Kathy, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
It's been great, and we'll see you on Wednesday, March the 8th at 7 o'clock at Salon in Manhattan for the Women for Wine Sense event.
With bells on.
Thanks very much, Kathy.
She's wearing the bells, Mark. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon. Again, we will put that up on our website, the event at Salon, where you can try some really amazing wines. It's the Women in Wine Sense is the beneficiary, and all of the winemakers are women.
And also don't forget that tomorrow night we're having our wine dinner with George Hendry at Stage Left Restaurant.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You know, Mark and I were talking over the commercial, and we're thinking about, you know, we made some references to, we go to places and sometimes in wine dinners, and they just get it wrong. They get it all wrong.
We love to go to wine dinners. I love when people match food and wine and do that for me.
And Mark said for the last, and, you know, there are many times when they do it right a lot, and then they just get one course that goes terribly awry, you know? And things like that can happen, things that we often pull off, like we'll find, you know, you find a chive on the dish that wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah, we've said that a couple times.
And
the reason we've said that is because sometimes the chef is putting a little accent or a little pepper or something.
Hand grenade into the plate. Boom! Oh, that's horrible. Anyway, chef doesn't know it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. He's thinking, oh, what a pretty green color I put on the plate.
The chef we have now is incredibly intelligent and very wine sensitive and wine savvy, and he insists as well that we taste the wine and the food together, which is great. One of our prior chefs from a long time ago, who had a contentious departure. I remember did the only real stage left gaffe.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, boy.
And fortunately, it was during a blizzard. Now this wine. It wasn't a wine dinner. It was a bourbon.
It was
dinner.
A bourbon dinner.
Colonel Elmer T. Lee. And I feel it's only fair to give the only example to be when we screwed up. Colonel Elmer T. Lee came to do the only bourbon dinner we ever did. He's in charge of the Ancient Age Distillery in Kentucky. He's a true Kentucky colonel.
And I can tell you why we don't do bourbon dinners anymore.
So anyway,
because they drink too much. People drink too much at bourbon.
Colonel
dinners.
Lee came, and he's this little man. Colonel Lee came in, having some bourbon. Thank you so much. Whatever. I do a terrible Kentucky accent. Anyway,
yeah, that was awful.
He came in, and there's a blizzard. We figure the play. Everyone's going to cancel because there's a blizzard. Mm-hmm. No, everybody shows up, and then some. Well, our chef. Again, this was a chef a long time ago, years ago.
No, it's longer than that. It's almost 12 years ago.
Well, he liked to wing it a lot, and he had gotten in...
good,
what did he
good
get
play
in?
On words. Wood hen.
He got in Scottish wood hen, and we were like, did you ever cook that before? And he said,
yeah, of course I did.
Well, we now know that wood hen is a very gamey meat that you usually soak overnight. Mm-hmm. And when you cook very slowly over a long period of time because it's very tough.
Very tough, and it holds a lot of blood.
Well, this guy got him in, threw him on the grill, served him like...
Grilled wood hen.
Awful.
It was one of the most disgusting foods of my career.
Fortunately, everybody had 7 bourbons, so they didn't care. But we were horrified, and he wanted to be adventurous, this guy, this chef dude, and he served it foot on.
Oh, yeah.
The wood hen came out with the feet on. I wanted to crawl under the table.
And in case you're ever wondering, the worst food we've ever served.
And that is the last time anything ever came out of my kitchen for wine dinner that I didn't try beforehand. Feet on. Even Colonel Lee was a little horrified with that one. He's from Kentucky. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.